Good morning, everyone, and welcome to OSB Group's 2022 preliminary results, and thank you for joining the call today. We had originally intended to hold a good old-fashioned in-person meeting, but the train strike situation meant the take-up was minimal. Anyway, hopefully you'll find our results, as usual, are somewhat more reliable than public transport. I'm going to start by covering the key highlights in terms of the performance for the year and an overview of the group. April will then take you through some more detail in terms of the numbers, and you'll then hear a little more from me on how our lending and savings franchises have performed, followed by the outlook before we open up to Q&A. I'm delighted that we have had a record year for profit before tax, up 13%, whilst retaining our class-leading 24% return on equity. This performance was supported by an improved net interest margin, strong loan book growth, and good customer outcomes. All of this demonstrating the strength of our strategy and business model. Our lending franchise continues to perform strongly, with originations accelerating, particularly during the second half, to deliver 12% growth in our loan book for the year. We continued our relaunch of products during 2022, progressively expanding our criteria towards pre-pandemic levels, including reintroduction of broader LTVs and an increasing number of mortgage products on the shelf. All of this is underpinned by our underwriting expertise and strong risk management capability. Credit performance remained consistently strong, with 3 months arrears stable compared to last year. However, a deteriorating macroeconomic outlook, together with a post-model adjustment for the growing cost of living and borrowing cost concerns, led to an increase in our impairment provision. Capital remains strong, and April will cover more around our capital management framework later in the presentation. Although I will add that we remain well positioned for strong capital generation and are committed to returning excess capital to shareholders. And I'm therefore delighted that we have announced a new upsized £150 million share buyback program, as well as a special dividend. As we announced at the half year, the group intends to target a CET1 ratio of 14% once the capital stack has been fully optimized through Tier 2 and MREL issuance. And April will talk more about this later. Looking ahead, we have a somewhat more sanguine outlook for 2023 than we did a few months ago, and we're still excited by the opportunities in our core markets. I'll cover more on the outlook towards the end of the presentation. The following two slides contain both our statutory and our underlying financial performance. However, I'm going to hand over to April to talk you through the numbers in a little more depth.
Thank you, Andy, and good morning, everyone. I'm delighted that we maintain the exceptionally strong underlying return on equity of 24% in 2022. Our profitability strengthened significantly, with underlying profit before tax increasing by 13% versus the prior year to a record £591 million. We grew underlying net interest income by 18%, due primarily to growth in the net loan book and a strengthened net interest margin, which was up 21 basis points to 303 basis points on an underlying basis, primarily due to the beneficial impact of rising base rates. More on that later. We have continued to maintain our strong focus on cost discipline and efficiency. As previously guided, our underlying cost-to-income ratio increased marginally by 1 percentage point to 25%. Reflecting the anticipated return to a more normalised level of spend post-pandemic, inflationary headwinds and planned investment in the business, and that included refreshing and upgrading our technology infrastructure post-integration. This was moderated by strong income generation in the year, including a sizeable net fair value gain on hedging activities, which I'll come to a little bit later. The underlying management expense ratio of 80 basis points was 10 basis points higher than in the prior period, reflecting that higher level of spend. Looking ahead, we expect our underlying cost to income ratio to increase to around 29% in 2023 due to those significant fair value gains from hedging activities in 2022, as well as continuing inflationary headwinds and the full year impacting of hiring we did last year, as well as some further planned investment in the business to deliver further efficiencies and also meet the evolving needs of our customers. We recognized an underlying loan loss equivalent to a ratio of 14 basis points in 2022 as the economic outlook worsened, and I'll provide more detail on the key drivers a little bit later. Turning to the income statement, you'll see that we recognised net underlying fair value gains on financial instruments of £48.5 million, more than double the prior period. These are non-cash gains which amortise back to profit and loss over the life of the hedges, with the largest driver being gains on unmatched mortgage pipeline swaps due to the step-up in swap pricing following the September mini-budget. Also on this slide, you can see underlying earnings per share of 99.6 pence increased by 15%, which is commensurate with the increase in profit after tax. Turning to the balance sheet, this summarises our strong, secure balance sheet. We delivered £5.8 billion of gross new lending in 2022, which is up 29% on the prior year, as we returned, as Andy mentioned, to pre-pandemic criteria in our core buy-to-let and residential subsegments, and also cautiously relaunched additional commercial and bridging products. This, together with our continued focus on retention, drove a 12% increase in the net loan book to £23.6 billion. Retail deposits grew by 13% to £19.8 billion at the end of the year, as the group continued to attract new savers. We remain predominantly retail funded, but we do have diversification provided by Bank of England funding schemes as well as securitisations. We drew down around £300 million under the Index Long-Term Repo Scheme during the year, and our drawings under the TFSME scheme remained unchanged at £4.2 billion. The credit quality of our loan book remained very strong, with three-month plus arrears stable for the group at 1.1%, and at the segment level, that included OSB at 1.2% and CCFS at 0.9%. Our loan book remains secured at very sensible loan-to-values. The weighted average book loan-to-value for the group fell to 60%, from 62% in the prior year, supported by house price appreciation. And the new lending loan-to-value increased slightly to 71% from 69% in 2021, reflecting that return to pre-pandemic lending criteria. The next slide is NIM. It shows our NIM waterfall, where you can see the high-level drivers behind that strength in NIM. So as I mentioned earlier, NIM increased to 303 basis points from 282 basis points in the prior year, again, primarily due to the benefit of base rate rises. But if I go through the chart, the retail funding spread benefited from delays in the market passing base rate rises on to savers in full, especially in the first half of the year, and that includes the back book of our easy access savings. The cost of new retail funds also benefited from widening swap spreads and the fact that all of those rises had not been passed on. On the other hand, there were also delays in mortgage pricing, reflecting the rate rises and the widening swap spreads in full. This was partially mitigated by an expectation of higher reversionary income following the end of the fixed period due to the higher base rate index, partially offset by an expectation that customers would spend less time on this higher rate before refinancing. And the other primarily relates to the benefit of increased average funding from Bank of England and also from our own equity, as well as favourable swap margin calls, which increase liquidity. The underlying NIM for 2023 is expected to be broadly flat to 2022 after the expected impact of planned Tier 2 and MREL qualifying debt issuance, albeit the exact quantum of the debt issuance drag will of course be subject to market conditions. Turning to the next slide on impairments, this provides our usual waterfall explaining the movement in the statutory impairment provision during the year, and I'll talk you through this. And if we move from left to right, house price appreciation over the course of the year outperformed our model's assumptions, which led to a release of around £10 million. Modelling and staging enhancements reduced by around £8 million, and that largely reflects the decrease in pandemic-related risks. These movements were offset by an £11.6 million increase to reflect the adoption of those more severe forward-looking macroeconomic scenarios, and you can find those at the very end of the presentation materials. A £13.3 million increase for post-model adjustments, and that's primarily to account for the rising cost of living and borrowing concerns. The significant increase in the size of our loan book this year, together with profile changes, led to a further increase in the provision of around £15 million. And finally, the other bar includes items such as changes to individually assessed provisions. Looking at our coverage ratio, you can see that the total coverage ratio increased by 7 basis points in the year and remains more than twice the level it was pre-pandemic at the end of 2019, as geopolitical, inflationary and cost of living concerns have replaced pandemic-related concerns. Looking in a little bit more detail, you can see the increase in Stage 2 balances. This is primarily due to accounts which are not in arrears, but which we have assessed as being more likely to be impacted by the worsening economic outlook, including the rising cost of living and borrowing. We will continue to proactively review our forward-looking economic scenarios and the coverage ratios as the outlook evolves. Next slide is capital. So looking at our capital position, you can see that the group's CET1 and total capital ratios remain strong at 18.3% and 19.7% respectively at the end of the year. Again, going from left to right in the waterfall, which explains the movement in the CET1 ratio, you can see our very strong capital generation from profitability of 4.8%. We utilised 2.8% to support the significant 12% growth in the net loan book during the year. Total ordinary dividends reduced it by 1.5 percentage points, which reflects a 30% payout ratio in line with the prior year and consistent with our stated desire to deliver a progressive dividend per share. You can also see the dilutive impact as we continue to amortise the fair value uplift on CCFS's net assets at combination, as well as the IFRS 9 capital add-backs. This takes the CET1 ratio to 20% before the distribution of additional capital. The 100 million share repurchase program was completed in November, and you can see also the effect of the 50 million special dividend we announced today. Looking ahead to 2023, we've also announced a further 150 million share repurchase program, which will commence tomorrow subject to market conditions, which is equivalent to approximately 1.4% of CET1. The board remains committed to returning excess capital to shareholders, and the £150 million share repurchase, combined with the 2022 ordinary and special dividends, represents a total cash return to shareholders of £332 million and demonstrates our commitment to return excess capital to shareholders in an efficient way. As we discussed at the half year, the group intends to target a CET1 ratio of 14% once the capital stack has been fully optimised through Tier 2 and MREL eligible debt issuance over the next 2 years. We note the PRA's recently published consultation paper on the implementation of Basel 3.1. We will be responding to that paper by the end of the month and await confirmation of the final rules, which we expect to be available by the end of this year. We've estimated the impact on our 31st of December 2022 CET1 ratio to be a reduction of up to 2 percentage points should the proposed rules be implemented as drafted in the consultation paper and prior to us receiving IRB accreditation. As previously guided, we have sufficient capital to support the temporary increase should this occur. The group continues to advance towards IRB accreditation with progress made throughout the year. We've completed a comprehensive self-assessment exercise to validate our level of compliance. Pre-application discussions have been held with the PRA, and we are now actively engaging with them regarding a Module 1 submission date. I'll now pass back to Andy, who will give an update on our lending and funding franchises.
Thank you, April. Our lending franchises are a story of doing the right thing for our customers, driving retention and delivering growth, whilst maintaining our position at the forefront of the market. Originations in our core subsegments, buy-to-let and residential, have been encouraging, both in terms of the significant volume increase and also the quality of those applications. Commercial has performed particularly well too, reporting a near tripling of originations following our renewed focus in that subsegment. The group has delivered this improvement despite the strong prior year comparison, which, as you know, was boosted by the stamp duty holiday. Average interest coverage ratios for new originations were 207% and 191% for OSB and CCFS respectively, and our LTVs remain sensible in all segments. Professionalisation of the buy-to-let market continued with 86% of OSB buy-to-let completions by professional landlords in the period, a transition that continues to play to our strength. I'm proud that we supported our customers and broking partners by honouring both the offered and the pre-offered pipeline in the wake of the September mini-budget. This provided stability during an uncertain time and underlined our long-term commitment to the market. Actions such as these enhance our reputation for service, which continues to be recognised in industry rewards. Our funding platform continues also to serve us well. Our retail savings strategy of attract, retain and satisfy saw over 190,000 new savings accounts opened across our brands, which is more than twice the number opened in the prior year. We also retained 94% and 88% of maturing deposits with OSB and CCFS respectively. Net promoter scores remained high at over plus 60 in each brand, although they were somewhat impacted by the exceptional volume of new account openings and the out-of-season ISA season that materialised once rate rises increased the attractiveness of these products again. However, I'm pleased the process improvements we quickly implemented are now showing a return to the exceptionally high 2021 levels. We continue to enjoy Bank of England funding through TFSME and the indexed long-term repo scheme. The group's collateral position continues to improve as well, and in the summer we completed a £1.3 billion fully retained securitisation of buy-to-let mortgages, predominantly for use as collateral with the bank. Before concluding, I want to take a moment to reflect on the progress we've made during the year in delivering for our customers and our vision to maintain our leadership position in the specialist lending market over the next decade. As you can see on the left-hand side, we've taken a series of actions this year that demonstrate that we are continuing to place the customer at the heart of what we do. I mentioned earlier how we supported customers through the period of uncertainty following the mini budget. We also published our landlord leaders research to understand our customers, their aspirations, and their approach to sustainability. This has led to the formation of a community forum, the launch of a £50 million property improvement fund, and practical help for customers who are yet to incorporate. We've also continued to launch new products, including those that help landlords meet future EPC requirements. And all of this continues to help to consolidate our position as the customer's lender of choice and the leader in our chosen market. However, we're not content to stand still. Looking to the right, you can see an overview of the actions we will be taking to keep the bank future ready. We will use the time when the market does not provide double-digit growth opportunities to enhance our capabilities. These enhancements will range from leveraging digital solutions to support our deep underwriting expertise to improving the experience of both brokers and customers through the creation of new customer journeys. And these are medium-term objectives to ensure that OSB retains its leadership position in the market, and we'll of course keep you updated as we progress. So in summary, a strong performance across all key metrics in the year. Our high-quality secured lending book continues to perform well with arrears flat to last year, high interest coverage ratios maintained, and a reduction in the LTV on our back book. Looking ahead, the UK mortgage market as a whole is forecast to be subdued in 2023, with a particular reduction in expected purchase activity. The buy-to-let segment is also predicted to see a reduction in lending following a strong 2022. However, whilst part-time landlords may be more sellers than buyers in the year ahead, professional landlords, who comprise the majority of the group's lending, remain active buyers and are looking favourably at opportunities supported by continued strong tenant demand and rental growth. We remain, of course, cognizant of the uncertain macroeconomic outlook and the potential impact of the higher cost of living and borrowing on the mortgage market and its affordability. However, we are building a healthy pipeline of new business and have a proven track record of retaining customers, attracting new ones, and working with high-quality borrowers. Based on current application volumes, we are targeting underlying net loan book growth of circa 5% for 2023. And as we look at current pricing and funding costs, we're expecting the net interest margin to be broadly flat year on year, even after the impact of the anticipated debt issuance, and we expect the cost-to-income ratio to rise to circa 29% this year. The group has a proven track record of delivering strong results with a clear strategy and a robust risk management framework. We have consistently demonstrated our resilience, which allows us to look to the future with optimism. Our latest set of results underline the quality of our business model and the strength of the OSB Group's balance sheet. Thank you for listening, and the operator will now open up to Q&A.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. We have our first question comes from Benjamin Toms from RBC. Benjamin, your line is now open.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my questions. The first one on guidance, please. If I stack up your various bits of guidance, it sounds like there are some tailwinds and some headwinds to ROE in 2023. In terms of the tailwinds, flat NIM and some loan growth should mean a better NII, and I guess the nature of IFRS 9 and the sizable management overlay should mean that cost of risk is lower this year, and the large buyback should bring down the E in the ROE. And in terms of headwinds, you're unlikely to get a repeat, I guess, of the fair value gains, and cost growth will probably be higher, I expect, than NII. I guess my question is, if you stack all this together, do you get to a position where ROE is probably slightly down year over year, but still meanly above the 20% mark? And then secondly, on capital, you've guided that your expected impact from Basel 3.1 is up to 2 percentage points of capital. I accept that there may or may not be a timing difference between the implementation of Basel 3.1 and the bank receiving IRB approval, but do you expect that the benefit from the latter should largely neutralise the headwind from the former? And as you go back to the regulator and respond to the rules laid out in the consultation, what areas are you most hopeful may eventually get repealed or watered down? And do you think the events over the last week in the US could impact the willingness of the regulator to roll back and implement soft regulation than initially laid out on UK banks? Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. April, I think they're probably mostly ones that you will want to cover. I'm happy to talk about the consultation if you want, but I think guidance on directional travel and IRB and 3.1 versus IRB.
No, I'm happy to take these. If I start with ROE, I think that was a very good summary, Ben, actually. Included in our cost guidance is the sort of full year impact of the people we hired last year. It was a big hiring year for us. And clearly wage inflation and other inflation will continue. Clearly inflation is expected to moderate but not go backwards. And we continue to invest in the business. And I think we've always invested in the business within the sort of economies of scale that our double-digit growth has generated. But I think, as Andy outlined, we're totally committed and in a very strong position to continue to spend that and invest for the future, even in a year where perhaps we're guiding single-digit growth. But yes, I think you've picked up the sort of positives and drags very effectively there in your summary. Turning to Basel 3.1, I mean, the reason we've sort of guided up to 2% is that some of the complexity in the rules that they've published, we actually, in common with every bank, have some data gaps, just to explain that. And we've assumed, obviously, that where we have data gaps, we can't take advantage of favourable treatments. But there were quite a few surprises in the consultation paper. I think I'd previously talked about a kind of a worst case and a mid case theoretically with you guys, and I think we probably ended up closer to the worst case than our mid case. And I think the areas we'll be particularly focused on is, asking for a transition period for standardized banks who are too big to take advantage of the strong and simple regime, just in the way that, IRB banks have been given a five-year transition. So that will be an area that we will be maybe idiosyncratically including in our response. I think that's very reasonable because as a large buy-to-let lender, clearly the significant increase in risk weights is largely coming from buy-to-let for us. We have a nice offset from our resi book, very low LTV resi book. That's giving us a nice offset. And the loss of indexing, which is available if you're IRB but not apparently if you're standardised, is another area of lobbying. Perhaps commercial, where it's underpinned at 100%, sort of floored at 100% risk weight for mortgages, but 75% if you're lending unsecured to the same business. So there's a few areas there on the risk weights. I think the other thing the whole industry through UK Finance is making clear, if you don't announce the final rules until the end of the year, you can't possibly expect everyone to make the necessary system changes by 1st of Jan 25. I'm hearing that they're trying to align to Europe and the US, and if the Europe and the US take longer to implement, they will too. And I don't think the US have got a consultation paper out yet, just to put that into perspective. So that's kind of the sort of key areas of perhaps interest. I mean, what they did is platinum plate, the actual CRR. Are the events of the last few days going to change that? I'm not sure. I mean, this is the PRA, not the Bank of England Resolution Authority. I think we'll have to see how this all plays out and whether or not there's a positive or negative sort of connotations. I think, you know, what happened with Silicon Valley Bank is sort of very different regulatory regime to what we already have in the UK. If anyone has any questions, of course, happy to answer those later. But it's hard to see a parallel situation for ourselves. I guess, does that sort of answer all your various strands?
Very good, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben. With our next question comes from Grace Dargan from Barclays. Grace, your line is now open.
Morning, thank you for taking my questions. A couple from me, if I can. So firstly, around landlord affordability. Obviously, you've had quite a stable ICR, but what are you seeing year to date? Has that stayed stable at the start of the year? And I guess noting the rental increases that you think landlords are being able to pass on, maybe could you give us a sense of kind of the average net rental yields the landlords are seeing on properties? And then maybe just finally, comments around the professional landlord demand are really helpful. Do you think there is a widening gap of affordability between professional and amateur landlords? Be interesting to get your take on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Grace. I'll tackle those two. I mean, landlord affordability. I think when in the sort of aftermath of the mini budget, when swap rates sort of skyrocketed, you know, we were looking at where, and the whole mortgage market was looking at where you might price fixed rates, not just for residential, but for buy to let, and thinking, God, blimey, rents are going to have to go up a fair bit before, you know, those loans create the kind of yield that either meets your interest coverage ratio hurdle, which is, you know, typically a minimum of 125 for a limited company structure and 140, 145 for a sole name. However, obviously, as we know, swap rates have come off. And while there is for borrowers that are maturing from 5-year fixed rates that they took out 5 years ago today, there is an affordability shock. Of course, they've had several years now of quite strong rental increases, and across the UK rents have gone up, you know, anything from sort of, 10% to 20% in some areas where property is in demand. And landlords at the moment are facing a situation where they don't have to take offers on their properties because there's so much tenant demand, particularly in decent quality stock, that actually they're able to hold out for those higher rents and get the tenancies filled very, very quickly. So, you know, with what we now think is the direction of travel in terms of Bank of England base rate, what we think the impact of that is on swap rates, we think affordability is still there. It will preclude some from sort of new deals who want to really highly gear those new deals, and for a while will have a bit of a dampening effect on the purchase market, as we touched on earlier. But, you know, the prognosis for affordability looks good. Obviously, you'd expect us to splice and dice our book and make sure we thought, as deals matured, people could afford the next yield of loan. Lenders also do things with product construct. So, you'll put on a larger arrangement fee onto a loan, which is capitalized over the term of the loan to keep the pay rate, within tolerances and more manageable. And of course, we will all have products that offer borrowers that sort of facility if they want to do it. The affordability piece between professional and amateur, I mean, there's a bit of an affordability dynamic between residential and rent. The gap is closing back down again. For a while it was cheaper to buy than it was to rent, and that gap has really closed. Cost of mortgages for first-time buyers is pretty strong, pretty high. And of course, they've got to come up with a sizable deposit because there aren't really any high LTV, well-priced first-time buyer products on the market, and therefore rental is enjoying a very, very strong demand as a function of that. We just think professional landlords with multiple properties have a spread of risk. You know, it's interesting, Ben asked the question about the consultation. I mean, one of the points I will continue to make to the regulator is I do not understand why they think there's a higher risk rate weight requirement for a multi-property landlord versus a single property landlord, because actually having a spread of risk, i.e. not all your eggs in one basket, means that you can have tenants changing at different times across the portfolio. You can have maintenance requirements on some properties at different times in the portfolio. It's not like all the bills come at once on a single debt, where if you haven't got a tenant paying, you've got a problem because you've still got to pay the mortgage. So we just think the market will continue to professionalize. We think that's the way to go. I think that's a better outcome for tenants as well, because, you know, professional landlords sort of know what they're doing. They understand upcoming legislation. They're already making moves to drive the energy efficiency of their properties upward because they know it's potentially likely they'll have to have higher EPC ratings. And that's why we continue to back that population. So we think the affordability dynamic looks okay. Does that answer your question, Grace?
It does. Maybe I could just press you if you do have any comment around the net rental yields you're seeing at the moment.
It's massively different according to geography. I mean, you know, anything from kind of 4% to, I mean, on HMOs, you know, and student let accommodation, you can see yields are sort of 9%. And of course, remember that professional landlords aren't only in it for a quick income buck, they're also in it for the longer term capital appreciation. So they're factoring longer term capex, capital appreciation, sorry, into their yield calculation. But, you know, rental yields have been growing over the last few years. And I say it is wildly dependent on geography and supply and demand.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Grace.
Thank you, Grace. We have our next question comes from Edward Pfaff from KBW. Edward, your line is now open.
Oh, good morning. Thanks very much. Can I just bring you back to the whole capital and MREL thing, because it seems that we've got quite a lot of moving parts over the next 12, 18 months. So just in terms of firstly, the Basel 3.1, the up to minus 2%, is that the total impact you expect from the total implementation of Basel 3.1, or is that just the initial impact and then there will be a later one, because as I understand it, the rollout has the credit coming in later? So that's my first question. Should I give you all the questions, or do you want to knock them off
let me get that one very quickly, if that's okay.
Yeah,
no, that's
the
full hit. There's no transitional arrangement if you're a standardized bank, so
okay,
it's a single,
so
you know, one. That's a total one, you know, one day it's one figure and the next day it's 2 percentage points off the CET1 ratio.
Perfect.
But only if it's implemented as written in the consultation paper and prior to us obtaining IRB accreditation. And as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, we've got the capital set aside in case that happens. And so it's a temporary thing only. But yeah, that's how it works.
No, perfect. And for the IRB, could you just update us on where we are with that? And have you given any sort of guidance or any help you can give us in terms of, is it equal and opposite? Is it more? Is it less? You know, just some sort of, because it's been going for quite a while now, and I would imagine you're beginning to get some clarity.
Well, I mean, I can certainly, I'm not going to tell you what's in our models, but I mean, you know,
no, sure,
to some extent, we can model it out as we go through the process of the accreditation, you know, whether the regulator agrees with all of our models, of course, or whether they want to put some initial output floors on it. So I think it certainly mitigates all of the impacts of Basel 3.1. Whether we get more benefit beyond then, of course, is a question for where the consultation lands and therefore where the IRB underpins land.
Sure.
But yeah, that is,
okay,
it will mitigate it, yeah.
Great, and then the other question was about sort of MREL and funding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess it's a particular focus at the moment given what's going on in the market. Is it possible to give us some idea, and I guess I could go through every single instrument and work it all out, but I'm sure you have it in your head. As we look over the next 12 months, how much MREL do you have to issue, and how much do you want to issue, I guess. So in terms of your planning, you've obviously got a plan in there in terms of the 150 million buyback. Do you have to issue a certain amount of MREL in order to deliver that? And how much do you have to deliver to refinance an existing MREL instrument? So some sort of idea of what the sort of dynamics are around that would be helpful. And then the second question is, I guess, we're still quite a way away, but you've got quite a lot of TFSME, I think, in your balance sheet. As we roll up towards that, could you replace all that with retail funding if you chose? I mean, how should we expect the balance sheet to move? At the moment, you're slightly long assets, loans to deposits. Do you think you could feasibly bring your retail deposits up to match your loans if you needed to, rather than having to rely on the wholesale market? Thanks very much.
Right, some very good questions there, Ed. I'm afraid I'm not really going to answer your first question. I mean, I think you understand that in the markets, to try and give an expectation of quantum, timing, and even cost, it is probably something that would be, you know, inappropriate for me to speculate on.
Could you highlight what's running off, though?
Nothing. We don't
okay.
have any
right.
holding. Yeah. But as soon as we sort of see an opportunity in the market and we start to issue, of course, we'll give an update. I mean, perhaps all I could guide you towards is we have somewhere in the appendices, given our capital requirement and our current mm-hmm. capital resources charts for a kind of a fully optimized balance sheet. And our interim MREL requirement from July 24 is 18% of risk-weighted assets.
Yeah.
We have the regulatory buffers, the counter-cyclical and the conservation buffer on top of that. So you're kind of looking at 22.5%. And I think you'd expect us to have a bit of a board buffer on top of that. And we've given okay. you our capital resources, total capital resources at the moment. You can take off the share repurchase. And I think it should, you know, and if you think about growth in your model, you should be able to kind of get there. But what I don't want to do, is, particularly as an issuer, is give out to the market exactly what we want to issue when, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, certainly not at the moment.
So I'm sort of dodging the question a little bit, but hopefully sort of this allows you to kind of get your model to
super
work.
Helpful.
And if you want to have any questions, obviously reach out to the IR team as well if you want to socialise it with them. On TFSME,
sure.
You know, I think the whole industry has a bit of a cliff event, don't they, in October 25. Mm. And we are planning to start repaying early. So probably from next year, we'll start to look for opportunities to repay. And right now, the cost of retail funds is super favourable. Well, perhaps before the swap spreads came in, we were able to raise a mix of retail funds at maybe SONIA minus 30, minus 40. So it makes sense to actually then repay Bank of England funding at SONIA. You know, a base rate. So we might do a little bit of that opportunistically, which is fairly neutral, I think, to NIM and clearly beneficial to the bottom line. Our primary intention is to use wholesale markets, but we want okay. to stage out our repayment, that if at the point of time that we're planning to repay, the wholesale market pricing doesn't look compelling, then we'll use retail funds. So I guess you might see us using a combination. If wholesale markets return to nice liquidity, we would plan to use mostly securitization. I think if there was a real dislocation in the wholesale markets, we would expect the Bank of England to extend the deadline, to be frank. And I think, you know, was it one of you asked me earlier about whether I felt that what had happened over the last few days might impact how the regulator here thinks about resolvability. And I think watching very carefully a cliff event for the whole industry and, you know, in those circumstances, wanting to take positive action earlier, maybe that might be a benefit coming out from what, you know, the learnings of the last few days.
Sure.
But hopefully that's a fairly fulsome answer.
No, it's super helpful. Very helpful. Thanks very much indeed.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Edward. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask any further question, please press star followed by one on telephone keypad now. With our next question comes from James Invine from Societe Generale. James, your line is now open.
Hi, good morning to both of you. I've got a couple, please. The first is a follow-up to Grace's question about ICRs. I hear what you say about the fact that anybody refinancing in 2022 has enjoyed 5 years' worth of rental growth and so on. But I guess the same would also have applied to anybody refinancing in 2021 as well. So I can't quite square the circle how in 22 versus 21, your new business LTV has stayed basically the same, but your interest coverage ratios have gone up, despite the fact that obviously we've had much higher rates during 2022. So I was wondering if you could just help us work that one out, please. And then the second question is on your origination, the buy-to-let at $3.8 billion. I was just wondering if you'd be willing to split that, please, into origination from new-to-group customers and how much of it came from deepening penetration with existing customers, just kind of when we're thinking about how those might evolve in 23 and beyond.
Yeah, okay, thanks, James. They're both good questions. I mean, we continue to enjoy high ICRs. We typically always have done. Because we're in that professional market where you've got borrowers that have got, a blend within their portfolio, so they might have some multi-occupancy properties, they might have a bit of student, they might have a bit of semi-commercial, so a couple of flats above the corner shop type territory. But because of, professional landlords being a bit more savvy about looking for the yield, and also having equity across a portfolio that means they can tinker with their LTVs accordingly, we are not seeing, you do see the odd loan that is kind of coming through and it's only just scraping your minimum requirement for ICR. We continue to see a good, strong portfolio of interest coverage ratio across the piece. And, a deal that's refinancing today that was written 5 years ago, there has been quite a chunk of rental increase during that period of time, which sort of moves the ICR forward, depending on how much equity they're removing, et cetera. The new to group or existing, clearly we quote our retention numbers. We work very hard at not throwing business off the back of the truck. The majority of our originations are not necessarily new customers to group, but new loans. So some of it is existing customers refinancing in from other providers as their deals come to maturity. Some of it is existing customers expanding their portfolio. But a good rump of it is also customers newly coming to group who haven't had exposure with us before. But, as they're sort of portfolio grows or their deals come to maturity with lenders they've used in the past, their brokers are saying this lender will do you a service that is appropriate for what you're looking for. I don't think we publish a number, but exactly on
no, we don't.
Existing customers bringing new deals to us, but we work hard on both sides of the equation. So we do a good chunk of business with existing borrowers, and actually, I've said this before, at our senior credit committee where we look at all of our larger exposures to sanction those. If we have a borrower that's an existing borrower and we like them and they've got a good track record and the evidence suggests they've got good stock and they know what they're doing, we don't do committed facilities, but we do give a we're minded to do more indication, and what that does is it means for both the broker and the borrower that they know as that individual expands the portfolio, they've got a lender that's very happy to listen to the next part of their business expansion plan, and that again definitely yields for us. We've always done that, and I think it's wholly appropriate that we continue it.
Lovely, thank you very much. Can I just ask as a follow-up to the first one, what proportion of your new business is HMO, and what was it last year, please?
I don't know if we disclose that one, I'm afraid,
James. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks anyway.
Thank you, James. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now. With our next question comes from John Colin from Goodbody. John, your line is now open.
Morning, Andy. Morning, April.
Morning.
Thanks for the update and for the pretty reassuring guidance for 23 on margin, particularly for me. But just a couple of questions on capital. So, look, the first one is, and this has been asked before, I appreciate, but why aren't you returning more capital? I guess, and in an interrelated way, can you just remind us again why you're targeting a 14% CET1? Like, I look at Barclays, a global systemically important institution, and they're targeting 13 to 14. So what is it that you're not calling out here? Is there something the board is afraid of in terms of capital return? My second question is on IRB and probably a bit more strategic. I guess, first of all, look, we've been talking about it for the best part of 5 years. You still haven't submitted the Module 1 application. Your competitors are arguably getting closer. I mean, from a competitive position, you could be in a very difficult situation in the relative near term if another bank, one of your key peers, does attain IRB accreditation and is then conferred with the ability to underprice relative to where you sit for the same return. Just wondering, how worried are you about it? And would you push back against me if I was to say that the reality is you're years away from it yourselves? And then thirdly, look, very, very micro point, but and nothing that's presenting me with any concern, but in the past, Charter Courts did, I think at the end of 2017, disclose that their uninsured deposits, or sorry, their insured deposits were 97% of deposit balances. Just in terms of housekeeping, can you give us an updated number, give us a broad sense of the proportion of insured versus uninsured? Thanks.
Oh, that's a long list. Andy, are they all for me? Okay. So let's take the capital. There's nothing that we haven't publicly said about capital. I think it's looking for the most efficient way to return capital as we go through the journey of optimizing the stack. There were lots of factors as to how the board decided on 14%. It felt appropriate given the uncertainties and the outlook that we've already discussed at some length today, and we still feel that's appropriate, and that's the right level to get to when we have a fully optimized capital stack. I think we've disclosed and we've discussed every aspect of positive and negative potential on our CET1 ratio. So there's no concern that I'm not sharing with you. You know me, I'm always a plain speaker. We decided to do a special because we were constrained on how much share repurchase we could announce, because 150 million was the maximum amount any of the investment banks would do for us, given the liquidity in our shares. And we thought we wanted to return a bit more, and therefore we put the special on as well. And I think it demonstrates that we're willing to use all tools available to us. But I think by far the most efficient way of returning excess capital is share repurchase. And if we do that over a couple of years as we optimize the capital stack, I think that's probably the right thing for us to do for our shareholders, to be frank. And of course, we need regulatory approval for some of these actions. And it has to be done over the same time as you're issuing Tier 2 and you're issuing MREL. So there's really nothing else hidden there, John. And at the moment, the board feels very comfortable with 14% being the right target, given the economic outlook and given these uncertainties that unfortunately still prevail from a timing perspective between Basel and IRB. IRB, we're waiting for our date. There are limited resources at the regulator. They focus on the new models for the existing IRB. There are some of our competitors who perhaps started the journey slightly earlier than us. But because we're submitting a bit later, we're in the position that we are, materially compliant. And we've also had the advantage of hearing, not directly, but through the advisors, the kind of challenges that the regulator has made on sort of the big bank and the current application people on the models. Things like cyclicality, use of bureau data, and we're able to, you know, work on that alongside those people. So, you know, resources to one side, I would expect a faster run through the application process as a result of being in a much stronger position when the module one goes in. I appreciate that's probably what I told you at interims, but we really are, you know, at the point where we're discussing dates and hopeful that the regulator will find the resources for us. I think you also asked about insured deposits, didn't you? You know, it's broadly in a similar place. I mean, maybe a percentage or so, plus or minus. The vast majority of our deposits are insured, and you know, the vast majority of what we do is retail. We've got some very small corporate-style deposits. We don't actually disclose that number, but when you know, it's not materially out of sync.
That's very helpful, thanks.
John, I think, I mean, I would just add on the, you specifically asked the question about competitive disadvantage.
Oh, yeah, go for it, Andy.
Are we sweating that? Look, we're already at a competitive disadvantage. There's tons of IRB banks and tons of banks that have got significantly cheaper funding than us. But, you know, in the marketplace in which we operate, you need to, one, have a really detailed understanding of the market. You need to understand how to price for risk. You need to have balance sheet scale, you know, in order to have consistency of offering, and you need to have the operational capacity to deliver a service proposition that means that borrowers and brokers want to use you. We have never, I mean, I think I could probably say Kent Reliance has always been, as one of our big buy-to-let brands, probably the most expensive buy-to-let lender in the market, but we've never struggled to grow it. So I'm not particularly concerned that if we have a short overlap period, we're going to find an inability to write business, but you know, if the overlap period materializes, so be it, but we'll find a way to pick through it. We've never been the
I forgot that question, John. I would perhaps just add that because we are a specialist lender, the difference between the IRB models and the current standardized are nothing like as broad as the original IRBs. You know, the big bank, mainstream, low LTV, prime borrower, there's a big difference between the IRB and the current 35% standardized. But when you start getting into the more specialist markets that we're in, that differential is much tighter. And therefore, I think it's that temporary step up, and we wouldn't change pricing for a temporary step up should Basel come in before IRB accreditation.
Yeah, look, that all makes sense. Thanks very much.
Yeah,
thanks, John.
Good question, so John. Thank you.
Thank you, John. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask any further question, please press star followed by one on the telephone keypad now. When preparing to ask your question, please ensure your phone is unmuted locally. With our next question comes from Aman Rakha from Barclays. Aman, your line is now open.
Good morning, Andy. Good morning, April. Just two quick questions. On one is, if the Bank of England were to hike base rate from here, are you positively geared to rate hikes from here, given your expectations around pass-through and the way it impacts your NIM? Is that a potential source of upside that we should think about, or do you think,
to be honest, looking at the market expectation, there isn't really today an expectation of more rate rises. So I definitely haven't baked in any future benefit from delays in passing that on into the guidance. So if there were further rate rises and the market, you know, didn't pass that on in full to savers, then yes, there is potentially some upside. But I, at the moment, there isn't the expectation of that. But, you know, if rates go up a lot higher, there might be a little bit more of the book where we think they might struggle to meet the ICR hurdles. But I think even after the sort of the mini budget, there were still big proportions of the book that could have afforded the financing shock. But, I mean, I'm just drawing your attention back to the impairment provisions. When I mentioned we had post-model adjustments of about £13 million, and that was really deep dives into every part of our our book to see who we thought was most likely to be impacted by cost of living or cost of borrowing concerns. And that's everything from, you know, obviously knowing your residential borrowers, but if it's a buy-to-let landlord, using ONS data and the postcode of the property to work out the income decile of the people likely to rent it and what sort of affordability shocks they are facing. And looking at, you know, as Andy mentioned, maybe people in the past where we did lend at 125 ICR, you know, what rent increases have been seen in that area of the country? What do we think going forward when they come up to refinancing? So it's a really deep dive and a huge piece of work to come up with that sort of 13 million figure. Because what we did is we moved people into a lifetime loss, stage two, rather than a 12-month horizon in stage one. All forward-looking, of course, but I hope that gives you a sense of scale as well.
That's really helpful. Thanks so much. I guess the second question was just around, I think when we spoke post the Liz Truss affair, when swap rates are blowing out, and there was a real concern around the demand within your customer base and buy-to-let more broadly, and there was a suggestion, I think, that you'd be able to kind of potentially repackage the manner in which you charge interest on your customers. So kind of amortizing a chunk of the interest cost as an upfront fee and, you know, putting it into the life of the loan as a potential way of keeping the kind of monthly borrowing cost down for your customers. Are you having to do any of that? Or, you know,
specialist buy-to-let loans always have a relatively chunky fee that ranges from anything between 1% to typically 2.5%. We do have a couple of products on the shelf where the fee is 3% and it nudges the pay rate down slightly. We have been asked occasionally, and I mean occasionally, like a handful of times, by a borrower to structure a deal in a particular way because they've got plenty of LTV coverage. They'd like to amortize maybe a 6% fee over the five-year life of the loan and keep the pay rate lower because they're investing and doing works and, you know, making product improvement, etc. But we haven't seen a wholesale need to really manufacture products with super high fees versus super low pay rates. But it is a structural place you can go to, and subject to the LTV on the portfolio or the particular loan being good enough, landlords will go for that if it means that their cash flow is maintained while they're still considering sort of future capex and then growing the rent on the property over the period of the loan. So it happens from time to time.
Are you positively surprised by the resiliency of your customers then, the kind of demand that's coming through?
No, I don't think I am. I think because we're in the professional landlord market and because these guys are, you know, they're savvy operators. I mean, I know a number of the really big buy-to-let lenders in the UK personally, and, you know, they have had so many, you know, kind of problems to deal with, and they've found a way around it, and they've tweaked their business models. And, you know, I've talked before about a borrower that owns big chunks of West London, you know, significant chunks of West London, and over the years he's, you know, he's added and changed his business model to you know, kind of have a sort of food in the fridge model, if you like, where it's targeted at professionals. It's a lovely property. The broadband's fired up. The bills are all in. The thing is absolutely stunning in terms of the way it's furnished. You literally rock up, hang your clothes in the wardrobe, stick a bottle of Sauvignon Blanc in the fridge, and you're good to go. And he charges, you know, significantly more than a unfurnished, slightly grotty standard rent for that property, and is finding a way to generate yield. Landlords all have their pros, all have their idiosyncrasies about the way in which they leverage their particular skill portfolio and sort of geographic area to keep that going. So we're not surprised about the resilience because, you know, we target high quality borrowers and have been working with them, you know, over the last decade or so.
That's great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. Operator, we have probably time for one more because we are at time. If there is one more on the line.
Thank you. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask any further question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad now.
Okay, if we don't have any further, it is 10:30. I'd like to thank everybody for joining this morning. I hope you all have a good day, whether you've managed to get into London or not get into London or whatever. And we look forward to speaking to you all again soon. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.